This is an ABC podcast.
This is the WA Country Hour with Tara De Landgraaft on ABC Radio WA.
And yes, hello, Tara De Landgraaft with you on this Anzac Day, bringing you the Country Hour from the Esperance Studios for your Friday lunchtime. I have been left to my own devices. Richard Hudson's off to pre-game ahead of tonight's Dockers match. I do imagine Belinda Varaschetti is doing much the same. We know how much she loves football. So I've conned some Esperance locals into joining me in the studio on this lunchtime to talk seeding and grain prices, two of my absolute favourite topics. So we will hear from them shortly, and I'd love to hear from you today as well. If you're out in the paddock seeding, let me know. Send me a pic if you like. Our text number, it is still the same, even though I'm in Esperance, 0448 922 604. And we will, of course, head to the Weather Bureau at around 12:30. And before 1 o'clock, we're off to the Nullarbor, where the annual muster is underway at Rawlinna. And I'm not talking about droving stock. I'm talking about the region's big social get-together, which has been raising those vital funds for local charities that help in the bush for over 40 years. The event was called off due to flooding last year, so I'm excited to hear what's on the cards for 2025. So do hope you can stay with me for that. First, though, we are broadcasting from the Esperance Studios on this Anzac Day, and there was a special connection for farmer and livestock transporter Scott Lawrence at this morning's dawn service, where he fired the gunshot at the commemoration. Scott did so from a gun once belonging to his wife's grandfather. The 303 rifle has been used at the Esperance dawn service for decades, and several years ago came into Mr. Lawrence's possession. A founding member of the local 10th Light Horse Brigade, he says the family and farming ties run deep when remembering those who fought for our nation.
Hi, yeah, Scott Lawrence here, representing the 10th Light Horse Troop and do the gunshot for the morning. So the 10th Light Horse was involved back in the wars, so now we're just here as a reenactment group, helping to bring everything back for everyone and keep it all alive.
And who's involved in this? I mean, why is this something you wanted to get involved in?
Oh, look, we've been involved in the horse industry in the equine community around town for quite some time. The 10th Light Horse Troop, when they were looking to form one up, we were one of the ones that were contacted about getting things going. And it's just grown from there, and away we've gone. So, yeah.
And as a farmer, albeit you say you're a small farmer these days, but still having horses, having that connection to the land and being part of this, what does that mean to you?
Oh, it means the world to us. Yes, we used to family farm 5,500 acres odd out east of town. Family sort of decided to go our separate ways, so we did that. So I've now got a couple hundred acres, but still very much involved in the industry. Drive livestock trucks for a living now, so there's all that. But we've literally just run our Easter camp draft out at Munganup. Yeah, involved in all that as well. But yeah, we've strong ties to the rural community for lots of years now, so this was a natural progression getting involved in all of this.
And of course, horses played such a significant part in all of the combats that Australian forces have been involved in.
Yeah, they sure did. They were a huge part of it all. And yeah, especially the early wars, they were your only mode of transport back then, weren't they? So that's how it went.
Ironically, where we're standing, we can see the horses, but we can also see the electric vehicle charger. So it really does show you how times have changed.
It sure has come full circle, hasn't it? It's anyway, it is what it is, but we'll see how that goes.
And this morning, and for many years past, you've been the person to fire the shot at the service. Tell us the significance of that shot.
The gunshot signifies everything for everyone, I guess, as far as where it goes. So this came about, so my wife's pop, Philip Mills, was doing the gunshot for many, many years. And when he passed away, it was decided that it would be passed on down to us. Through the RSL, they gave us the gun and asked us to come and do this. So, yeah, absolute great honour to be able to do that for them.
So tell us what sort of gun you use for this service.
See, it's one of the British 303s that were used all during the World Wars, the last World War. And, yeah, it's absolute honour to be able to do it.
Is it any different to guns these days? Tell us a bit about how it actually, you know, how it works.
Yeah, it's a bolt-action rifle, so very similar to everything you've got now. A little bit older, been good old Woodstock and whatnot on it, but got all your synthetic crap these days. But yeah, absolute beautiful rifle, and yeah, absolute pleasure to own and shoot.
Now, we know there have been a lot of changes to firearm legislation in recent weeks. Has it been difficult to be able to keep this firearm?
Not yet. We're still waiting to see on that one. Yeah, we'll definitely be doing whatever we can to keep it. Yeah, I was slightly panicking about this one, but laws at the moment, they're sort of on stalemate, just waiting to get them all through. So mine hasn't been processed yet, so we'll see what happens, but we'll definitely be fighting to keep it.
Are you concerned that maybe in services into the future, there won't be a traditional firearm, there won't be that family history and those ties?
I'm definitely concerned about it. It's something that, yeah, had me quite worried coming into this. We've got away with it this year, and we'll keep talking to firearms and licensing and see what happens from here on out, but we'll push through, we'll find a way.
How important is it to have the firearm with the link to the family and to the region and to farmers in the region at a service like this?
No, it's incredibly important. It's a way of life. It's everyone's way of life. It's how it goes, and you can't do it without them. So we'll just keep pushing for it, see where we go.
And do you have to do anything special to keep it, I suppose, in tip-top order for the service every year? Is it the only time of year that you use it?
It actually is. I'll put a couple of rounds through it every now and then just to make sure everything's all still good and clean it up. But otherwise, it pretty much sits in storage, so we don't have any heartache with it. It pretty much just stays away. I use my other guns around the place when I need to and leave this one so that I can just do this.
And, of course, you are here as part of the 10th Light Horse. How do the horses go with the shot every Anzac Day?
It's not usually too bad. I'm far enough away from them that they handle it. We've done desensitisation work with them for it. Yeah, they handle it very well, and they do the brass band. They practice with the brass band and stock whips and all that kind of stuff throughout the year. So, yeah, quick crack like that's not always the end of the world to them, so they handle it pretty well.
And what does Anzac Day mean to you, Scott?
It's our way of remembering what our servicemen did for our life, and to have the freedom that we have means everything.
That's Esperance farmer and livestock transporter Scott Lawrence, who fires the shot at the local Anzac service using a historic gun belonging to his wife's grandfather. And we'll hear a little more about the nation's Light Horse Brigade in the second half of the program. Right now, though, it is coming up 13 minutes past 12. And April 25 not only commemorates those who have fallen throughout our history, but it's an important date on the calendar for many grain farmers. Anzac Day is, for many, the traditional break or start to the season. And while many farmers, especially in the northern ag region, are really still waiting for that break, here in the Esperance Port Zone, significant rain a fortnight ago means reseeding could even possibly be on the cards. Monica Field is an agronomist with Farm and General. Monica, it's almost a tale of two seasons, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it's been a very different start from the last couple. It's, kind of took us out of surprise, I guess, but it's been positive overall. Yeah, definitely.
How wet do some farms get?
That western side through Munglin up, the biggest fall I heard was 140, but, yeah, there was consistently around 100 around that side of town. And then as you moved further east, Cascade, some of that had 60 to 80, and then it kind of dropped away. And unfortunately for the eastern side of the highway, it slowed quite a lot. So those huge falls were mainly on that western, and I believe right up into Lake King had some heavy falls as well.
And it came pretty fast, didn't it?
It was pretty much a 24-hour period, yeah. There was, have a good drive around the last couple of weeks, and, geez, there's been some water move. It's been quite wild, really.
So will there be need for reseeding?
Not as much as we first thought. First thought was like, oh boy, this is not good, because there was some very, very big hectares of canola in the ground. I guess the last week has shown, there's going to be areas, but not as big and as widespread. It seems to be consistently the couple of days just prior to it that are the worst of it, and it's very much soil type as well.
So was it a case of, some of that canola was just seeded not very deep at all, and it's gone away, or has some gone down so deep now it's not able to get through?
Yeah, there's been lots and lots of furrow fill by far, but then there's also been movement of paddocks and like slopes and stuff like that, or there's also been some of those heavier soils they've kind of sealed, so it's quite hard for it then to push through and then push through that sealed kind of barrier that's there as well.
So being that it is the 25th of April, I mean, is there time to go again for canola?
Very much so, yeah, yep. And I think the last couple of years have showed, like, we can get away with low plant numbers, so we really have to be really, really positive that the plant numbers are that low that we have to be worth it. But we're still going to get a germination by the back end of April into early May, so we're still in a really good position for canola.
So for farmers who are wanting or needing to re-sow canola, I mean, can you get your hand on
it? You actually can. Seed's probably in the best position it's been for a number of years, and there's a big choice of what you can get in terms of, the Roundup Readies or the TTs, basically. So it's just making it fit to what you're doing, but it's probably going to be very similar to what you've already sown, because I don't think it's going to be one whole paddock the whole time. It's often going to be pieces and stuff here and there.
Mm. Which I suppose then brings on challenges come harvest time as well.
Yeah, it's not ideal. But the even, you know, it might only end up being two and a half weeks difference between the two different crops. And so that's not too bad. It's, you know, you think of last year, we had crops germinating from April into June. So it's probably still going to be a better scenario than like those really big patchy germinations.
Mm. And you mentioned there were some parts to the east of town that didn't get that big rain. They have had a little bit of follow-up rain though.
They have, yeah. No, luckily there was some falls through like that week of Easter. And most people are seeding into moisture, or they've seeded and then crops have come up. So both sides of town, we're lucky in most of this Esperance region, we've had pretty good falls. There's a few little pockets that are still a bit dry, but, you know, it's by far the best seeding we've had for a couple of years, yeah.
Mm. Now, you're part of the GIWA Crop Report Network. What are you hearing from other agronomists around the state? Because there are certainly other port zones which haven't been quite so fortunate.
Yeah, it's very variable. We did say we haven't heard about the albatross in Geraldton yet. That one hasn't turned up for those guys. So hopefully he starts laying, or she starts laying an egg, I should say. Yeah, variable. I think it's good in areas and then poorer in others. It just depends, unfortunately, what lucky falls you're under in the last 3 weeks. Yeah.
Mm. Maybe a little bit of twiddling of thumbs, given there wasn't too much summer rainfall about, not too much spraying that's happened.
I know, it's actually kind of weird the amount of other jobs you get done when you don't have to do a lot of summer spraying and stuff. But we've been lucky that we got some March rain that got a knockdown, and now we're having a couple of more knockdowns. So yeah, it's actually been very positive. We've had a lot germinate in that period. So before we go into crop, we'll have good opportunities.
Get some clean paddocks.
Yeah, hopefully. Mm.
April 25, traditional break of season, maybe not for this year?
I reckon, this is just my feeling, I don't think the April 25 date for canola anymore is correct, because I think you can yield more going earlier. It's always the question, how early is too early? And no one went in that back end of March that I was aware of with too much canola, which was probably a good plan, but we've got so much breadth of varieties and opportunities now that I think we can go before that date and still have really good situations, yeah.
Mm. And as you say, a bit wet around there at the moment. I hear that some people might try some aerial seeding even of canola.
Yeah, I have heard a couple of stories of, yeah, basically spread it out and then harrow it in or roll it in. Yeah, there's a few different techniques that have been done over the years with varying success, basically. Just depends on the situation. But I see why people are loath to put in a whole seeder and reseed paddocks, because sometimes it's not always needed. So, yeah, there's definitely different, unique ways of dealing with the problem.
Well, Monica, agronomist with Farm in General, thanks so much for joining us in the Esperance studios for the Country Hour on this Anzac Day. And look, I'd love to know from you, if you're out in the paddock seeding, maybe you're waiting for that break to happen. Our text number is the same, even though we are in Esperance, 0448 922 604. And whether you've started seeding or not, if you're a grain grower, I'm sure prices are never really far from your mind. But with a fluctuating Aussie dollar, nervousness, over over weather conditions and talk of tariffs hitting the headlines, it is tough to stay on top of it all. May Connolly is a grain marketing advisor with Famanco here in Esperance and joins us in the studios. May, should farmers be watching prices now given what's going on externally?
Yeah, so history tells us this kind of April, May, Northern Hemisphere weather market period is often one of the best pricing opportunities for the whole year. So whether you're holding a bit of grain from last season or you are in the lucky position where you can start looking at forward sales for this coming harvest, this does historically proved to be a very interesting time of year.
Mm. Now, we had a WASD out a fortnight ago. What's happening globally?
Yeah, so that WASD confirmed, again, stocks of most things are historically low, which usually does point towards higher prices, which we're not necessarily seeing at the moment. So a couple of key things out of that report. Global wheat stocks, about 260-odd million tonnes. That's actually the lowest of the last 10 years. And even more interestingly, if we look at the major exporter wheat stocks, stocks-to-use ratio there is the lowest since that crazy 07-08 period when prices were absolutely astronomical. So stocks are really low, but I guess that begs the question, well, if global stocks are this low, why aren't I getting $1 million a tonne for wheat at the moment? And the answer to that is the word that's usually the answer to a lot of grain marketing questions these days. The answer is China. So in that WASD report a couple of weeks ago, it also showed like the big kind of bearish factor in markets at the moment, or in wheat markets at least, which at China are just not buying wheat at the moment. So the last couple of years before this, they were buying 13, 14 million tonnes of wheat to import. In that WASD report, that was dropped down to about 3 or 4 million tonnes. So you can imagine a 10 million tonne drop in China's import demand. And a lot of that wheat was coming from Australia. It goes a long way to explaining why we're not currently getting $1 million a tonne for our wheat at the moment, despite the low stocks.
We are moving into, though, that Northern Hemisphere weather time. So really anything could happen, couldn't it?
Yeah, this is like Christmas this time of year for grain marketers. So it's usually the most exciting time of the year. And again, just I'll reiterate those really low stock levels. What that means is we don't need much of a crop production issue to really excite prices. So if no crop production issues happen, then, you know, it doesn't really matter about stocks. No one cares. But as soon as we do start getting some crop production issues, and if they're going to happen, this time of year is the most likely time they're going to happen. Those low stock numbers means the response in prices is going to be significant. And just one crop production issue I'll mention, again, our friends China. You know, the reason that they haven't been needing to buy wheat is they've had a fantastic crop, wheat crop of their own last year. It was looking like an even bigger wheat crop for them this year. They're going into their key period. You know, it's like us at the start of September. You can be sitting there on the 1st of September, everything's looking lovely. And sorry to give anyone PTSD here, but, you know, September can just go horribly wrong, too hot, too dry, too cold, and your beautiful crop is not so beautiful come the end of September. So exactly the same thing is happening in China at the moment. They were, you know, even a week or two ago, looking at a magnificent wheat crop. It suddenly turned really hot and really dry there. So as I mentioned, you know, if they're the key, you know, the key kind of bearish factor in the market at the moment. So if their crop does start to suffer from this dry, hot spell, they're going to start needing to import some wheat. And we've been their best friend in the wheat market for the last couple of years. So, yeah, so anything can turn on a dime really quickly over the next month. So it's really a good idea to be, even if it is a frustrating dry period for you, it's still a good idea to be keeping an eye on the pricing opportunities.
And you mentioned, obviously, there's looking ahead at weather overseas. But here at home, it's sort of been so variable between the East Coast, West Coast. And even, obviously, as we know, we just heard Monica mention, within WA as well. So have we already seen some of the local weather conditions impact local prices?
Yeah, and I guess another reason why, again, we're not getting $1 million a tonne for our wheat is a lot of the forecasts are actually really positive for not just the WA crop this year, but the Australian crop. So, you know, I guess if you're a trader and you're sitting there thinking, well, it's going to be a huge crop in Australia this year, and I know farmers are throwing tomatoes at their radios at the moment hearing me say this in April, there's obviously a long way to go, but the forecasts are good. So if you're a trader and you've got these kind of really positive forecasts for a big Australian crop this year, you're probably not going to go particularly hard with prices this early. But again, China start buying, a few production issues elsewhere, that's going to give traders confidence to buy, to want to go a bit harder buying Australian grain, even if it is a big Australian crop.
Well, that being said, and with so much still in flux, I mean, farmers haven't received the break of the season for many, especially in the northern ag region. I mean, should they be considering locking in prices?
Look, my view is production risk is always the first one to consider. So, you know how it works on your farm. You know what the worst case outcome is from here. If the worst case outcome from here, and I'm certainly not wishing it upon you, but if you know what your worst case outcome is from here, if that worst case outcome still allows you to be safely selling a bit of grain, I'd be looking out for pricing opportunities over the next month, because like I said, historically, this April-May period, even though it may not feel like it at the time, historically, this is, most years, this is one of our better pricing opportunities.
And is there anything in particular you think farmers should look out for? What are those opportunities? I mean, we've seen last season's, lupin's been absolutely crazy in the last week, but that's last season's crop. Is there anything in particular you think farmers should be looking out for?
This is where I'm going to be the boring numbers person, good old consultant. But if we take like feed barley, for example, new season feed barley prices around $335 a tonne fizz in WA. That doesn't sound particularly exciting, but that's a decile 8 price for the last 5 years. So if you've had rain, that kind of number works in your budget, makes your profit. I'd be looking at barley, whereas the canolas, both GM and non-GM, are kind of a decile 7 type number. So, and wheat's only about a decile 5. So, out of that, I think, again, what works in your budget and how your farm's looking is more important, but those deciles can be really good at taking the emotion out of prices and just reminding us where they really do sit in historical terms.
May Connolly, Grain Marketing Advisor with Famanco, thanks so much for joining us in the Esperance studios, this lunchtime for The Country Hour. Now, moving away from grain for a moment, because Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has promised if re-elected, his government will help the WA government in its bid to buy back the state's freight rail network. He also raised the prospect of the Commonwealth taking control of some tracks. Now, you might remember before the state election, WA Treasurer Rita Saffiotti announced plans to start negotiating with the network's owner, ARC Infrastructure, about bringing the tracks back into public hands. At a business breakfast in Perth yesterday, Anthony Albanese made an election commitment that they'll fund a $2.5 million due diligence and feasibility study. And he says part of that study will consider how the network could be integrated with the national rail network. Mr. Albanese talked about the possibility of the Commonwealth also taking direct control of the rail line between Fremantle and Kalgoorlie. City of Kalgoorlie-Boulder Mayor Glenn Wilson says it makes sense to streamline control.
We're a little bit surprised, but it makes a lot of sense, to be fair. Having the National Rail Corridor in an east-west section just to the east of Kalgoorlie-Boulder splinter over into a state-based system is probably not economical from a freight and logistics point of view, but having one continuous entity that controls that rail network moving forward is going to be positive for those people who use it, and also positive for the city of Kalgoorlie-Boulder. Our position on this network is crucial. You can go north, south, east or west from Kalgoorlie-Boulder to various different ports and to various different locations. And here in Kalgoorlie-Boulder, we can provide resilience, we can provide support, and also take off many of those trucks that are on the road and use our facilities here to reduce carbon emissions, which obviously the federal government and the state government have seen are crucial to an environmental platform moving forward. From what many people have let us know about who use rail, getting to Kalgoorlie-Boulder is the easy part. Moving it on from there is a difficult part under the two operator system that's currently in place to get from freight from the east to the west. By having one continuous, seamless approach for those providers, it allows better consistency. It also allows a more productive and more resolute system that providers will want to use in the future. Rail's not a new technology, it's been around for hundreds of years, but having this investment moving forward just goes to show that getting the rail up to speed, making sure that we've got options on the rail that are cost effective, will also take trucks off road, reducing emissions and making our roads also safer while utilising an existing corridor that's been in place for over 100 years.
That's City of Kalgoorlie-Boulder Mayor Glenn Wilson. Now, being a public holiday, we don't have any news headlines, and there won't be a full 5 minutes for you at 1 o'clock either, because we'll be heading to the football at 1 o'clock. But what we do have, come rain, hail, shine, everything in between, and to talk about those conditions is, of course, the Weather Bureau. Today's duty forecaster is Catherine Shelfout. Hope you're there, Catherine. I'm just playing with the little knobs here in the Esperance studio and hoping for the best. So can you tell us, we're starting here in Esperance, that's where I am. I'd love to know what's happening in the Southwest Land Division, please.
Hi, Tara. I'm here. Yes, rain, hail or shine. Yes, we were talking earlier about how cold you said it was at the dawn service this morning, and I noticed that it was very windy. Actual temperature at Esperance this morning was 15.9, but it feels like 10.8, so pretty chilly with those southerly winds pushing up off the Southern Ocean. It's been an active couple of days in the Southwest Land Division, but it has quietened down a bit now. So the cold front and low that was causing all that has now moved off, and I can see it just sitting over western parts of South Australia or just south of that. So really for southern WA at the moment, it's quite cloudy, apart from as far north as the central west and sort of north of Perth, still clear. But really a sort of a quieter few days coming up. So the main feature will be a ridge that's sitting over the Southwest Land Division at the moment. And it's going to sit around for the sort of the next 4 to 6 days, being quite slow moving. So on Saturday, we'll see that ridge sort of broadening out a bit, and the high centre will be sitting over the Great Southern. So very light winds over southern districts with a chance of fog overnight, south of about Mandurah to Norseman, mainly through inland parts. Temperatures dropping down to about 5 to 8 degrees through inland parts of the Southwest Land Division, and daytime temperatures tomorrow in the high teens through most parts and getting up to the low 20s near the west coast, and right in the northwest of the Southwest Land Division, around about 27 degrees at Northampton. Winds generally pretty light southeasterly, and it will be quite cloudy in southern parts with just a few showers along the south coast in that sort of onshore flow, but less than about 4 millimetres. On Sunday, pretty similar, light southeasterly winds and temperatures warming a degree or two through central and northern parts. Once again, a chance of fog through that sort of area south of Mandurah to Norseman. And showers maybe extending just a little bit more inland, but still only sort of south of about Manjimup to Ravensthorpe, only a couple of millimetres getting inland, but up to 4 to 8 millimetres around Hopetown and Bremer Bay. On Monday, that high will move east a bit and we'll see a trough forming near the west coast. So winds will start off southeasterly, but they'll be a bit more easterly by evening, and also a little bit stronger in northern parts north of about Badgingarra. So not too strong, still only sort of moderate, but a little bit gusty there. And as we get to that sort of more easterly flow, we see the showers decreasing along the south coast. So just a couple of millimetres possible there, sort of Walpole to Israelite Bay. Most of the shower activity will have moved a bit further east to the Eucla coast. And we will start to see temperatures warming near the west coast, so up to 31 for Geraldton on Monday. And still a chance of some fog through those southern districts. And for Tuesday, that high will move into the Bight, but it still has a ridge that sits back over the south coast. So those fine conditions will continue. Still got the west coast trough deepening offshore, so we'll start to see more of a northeasterly flow. There'll be quite gusty winds through northern parts in the morning, so north of about Mora. Elsewhere a little bit lighter, no rain expected on Tuesday, and temperatures warming up to the mid-20s through the Wheatbelt and into the 30s through the central west coast. And I'll just briefly mention that that trend does continue for Wednesday and Thursday. Thursday looks like the warmest and windiest day. And we do have on Friday our European model suggesting a cold front, but the Australian model not in agreement yet. So that's a watch this space.
Well, we'll cross our fingers for that, Catherine, especially with that warm weather expected in the Northern Ag region at the start of next week. If we do head further north, northern and eastern forecast districts, what's expected?
So really quiet in the north at the moment, mostly sunny. We have seen dew points dropping, and so minimum temperatures dropping down into the teens. So Kununurra was 15.5 last night, so dry season conditions really in play and probably a bit more pleasant for sleeping. Not much change for the next few days. Temperatures staying in the mid-30s for the Kimberley, the Pilbara and the northwest Gascoyne. We will see some gusty southeasterly winds pushing through due to the ridge, so particularly the Pilbara and North Interior tomorrow, and then again on Tuesday. Very slight chance of a shower or thunderstorm only through the western Pilbara on possibly Saturday, more likely Sunday, and then we'll maybe start to see some showers and thunderstorms just coming back into the eastern Kimberley from Monday and Tuesday, and that's because there's a very weak tropical low that's just moving past, not expected to be a cyclone, but we'll just bring a few showers and storms up there.
Rightio, any warnings we need to know about?
The only warning at the moment is a strong wind warning for the Eucla Coast. That was a gale warning earlier, has eased to strong winds as the low moves further east. And that's it at the moment.
All right. Catherine Shelfout, duty forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology. Thanks for keeping us up to date today.
Thanks very much, Tara.
Now, having a look at rainfall for today to 9 a.m. this morning across the state for the last 24 hours. Not much about in northern and eastern forecast districts, just a spattering in the Eucla, with Eucla itself receiving 5, Eyre 5 and Red Rocks 0.6 millimetres. And for the southwest land division forecast districts, over 5 millimetres, just a tiny bit in the southern coastal region. Beaumont West 5, Esperance Aero 5, Oakmarsh Farm 6 mil over 2 days, just slipped in there. Ravensthorpe 7 and Warrajarra 7 as well.
This is the Country Hour with Tara DeLandgraft on ABC Local Radio WA.
24 minutes to one. Well, a couple in the Great Southern has gone viral after sharing a social media post about the impacts of the phase out the live sheep export will have on regional and rural communities. Grant and Chrissy Smith are sheep farmers near Kojonup, around 300 kilometres south of Perth. The pair say they wrote the post on Facebook, sharing their story in the hopes it would explain a complex issue in a simple way and so city people understand.
Friend posted on Facebook about the election, and I made a 3-sentence comment in regards to the banning of the live sheep export. I got a reply to that asking if I could put it into perspective from someone from a grassroots and who's on the ground actually living it. And the other thing that she mentioned was she wondered whether we were over dramatising, like if farmers were over dramatising the ban. I went home to Grant and I read it to him. I said, we need to answer this question as honestly and as authentically as we can to give them an understanding of what it is that we actually do. I posted that reply, which we wrote, took us a long time to put it together, and it got really excellent feedback. And I suggested to Grant, I said, do you think we should put this on my personal Facebook page? And which we did. And it just went mad. It was quite incredible. It's up to 2,300 shares now.
I was just about to ask that. How many?
Yeah, 2,300 shares and over 1,000 likes, which blew us away. And we were worried about the negativity that might come with such a post. But so far, it has been so positive from all walks and areas of Australia.
What made you do it?
I think I just felt that, you know, we're fairly private and quiet people. And but when she said about the over-dramatising, I just felt, oh, is that what everybody's thinking? Because we're not over-dramatising this. We both felt that we just needed to explain our situation and a lot of other people that are in the same industry as us and give people the information that they needed.
What was the information that was in there?
Basically, we gave them a complete rundown of our farming practices in regards to the sheep industry and how we operate and, you know, what we do to produce a lamb, telling people that, you know, this impacts West Australians due to a lot of different issues. It's a complex issue. It's not just about numbers. It's about the climate and, you know, how long it takes us to produce a lamb from start to finish. I don't think people realise that, you know, this is a lot of planning that goes into this. It's 365 days. So we wanted to explain that. We wanted to explain what happens when, you know, they go to the lamb, the product that we produce. We take 365 days to produce that product, It then goes to the processors. They have it for one day and then it's shipped off to the supermarkets. It's packed, priced, and it's in the supermarkets for every consumer to buy.
Grant, what do you think is the, I guess, the divide that exists between the city and country? What do you think, it or does it exist?
I'm sure it does exist, Kate. And I think the thing is that everyone's sort of lost sight of where our food comes from. We are sheep farmers, but we produce food, and it's a very important product, same as grain farmers, same as beef farmers, same as egg, poultry, all that sort of thing. I don't think we've lost the touch where the kids in the schools actually go, I know this comes from a farmer. I pick it up at Woolworths or Coles or Aldi, but it actually comes from a farmer and someone's produced it. And we're those people. Yeah, like, and we take great pride in producing it. We love doing what we do. But I think the general public and definitely the politicians have actually lost sight of the fact that, yeah, they need to protect Australians' food security. If we don't produce the food, we don't produce the sheep, we don't produce food, you know, and it's a very crucial product to have.
Mm. Do you think, though, as well, the timing of an upcoming federal election has something to do with not only getting your message out, but getting the message of what farmers' roles are in Australia right now?
Well, I think it's probably a coincidence that it's happened at that time. That had nothing to do with when we posted it, but it is crucial that it's coming up to it. And I really do wonder whether Anthony Albanese actually put any thought process into if we lose 1.5 million sheep to export, yeah, which is what we will lose numbers. There's nothing surer. We already have on the back of COVID and then this decision. Yeah, we were exporting between 1.5 and 1.75 million sheep. Did he for a second think, oh, hang on, that's food that we're exporting to the world. How is that going to affect that country? Because I would say he 100% didn't even think about it. You know, they're not protecting Australian farmers. Australian farmers are leaders in what they do across all industries. We produce some of the best lamb, the best beef, the best grains in the world. And we're innovative. We try to do the best we possibly can for land care and definitely as far as animal welfare. You know, people that are in the industry now absolutely love their livestock. If they watch me go down amongst my flock and look after the flock, they'll realise I actually really care. And when I lose one for some reason, that actually really hurts.
That's Coaching Up Sheep Farmers Grant and Chrissy Smith speaking to Kate Forrester about why they shared a post online explaining the impacts of the live sheep export ban. And you can hear and see more of Grant and Chrissy this Sunday on Landline at 12:30 on ABC, or you can watch later, of course, on iView. Kate's Landline story will also take you to Perth, where both sides of the live export debate are making one final push in the lead up to next weekend's federal election. Well, one place that sheep are aplenty is the Nullarbor, and the Nullarbor's biggest community event kicks off today, the 42nd annual Nullarbor Muster. The event, which takes place at Rawlinna, around 380 kilometres east of Kalgoorlie along the Trans-Australian Railway line, was cancelled last year after massive floods cut access to the community and pastoral stations. So there's a few people determined to make the 2025 event even better than ever, especially given it's not just a boost socially, but also a big fundraiser for local charities. Kalgoorlie reporter Macy Turner has made the trek out to Rawlinna. Macy, tell us first of all, how did things look on the drive out after so much rain in the last 12 months?
Hi, Tara. Yeah, we were pleasantly surprised on the drive out. We were expecting a bit of a rough road and we were prepared, but the road was great. We found it in pretty good condition. There are a few, you know, iffy spots, a few potholes here and there. But, yeah, we took it slow and all smooth sailing on the way out.
So you've made it to Rawlinna. How are things looking for the weekend ahead? What sort of crowds expected?
They're looking good. So we've just chatted to the organisers and they're expecting at least 800 people. I'd say most of those people are here already. I'm looking around me now. We've got campers going up everywhere, tents, swags, people milling about and catching up. And weather-wise, it's pretty grey. It's overcast and it's very windy. It's blowing a bit of a gale. ABC camp is holding on by its tent pegs. So far, so good. But no rain, hopefully. Just a bit of wind. Everyone's going to keep their jackets on as they party on for the next few days.
And as you mentioned, you've been speaking with the Muster Club organisers, Macy. How are they feeling after having to postpone and then eventually cancel last year's Muster? They must be chuffed to finally get this year's event underway.
They are. They're stoked. We spoke to Cameron Day, the president of the Muster Club, and Sophie Law, his secretary, and they're just stoked to be back. Last year, they said the rains were, of course, great for pastoralists and the land around here, but not great for the muster. And this year, they're back with a bang. They've got $9,000 prize money for the rodeo, and for the first time, they've got five Eastern States competitors who've flown in for the bull ride. That's equaling the WA competitors. So it's really getting on the map in the rodeo scene, the Nullarbor Muster, and everyone's excited to be back and getting back amongst it.
And this event, it's really crucial for those station communities that live along the Nullarbor as that social outlet. But it's also really important for raising funds. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so back in 1964, the first iteration of the Nullarbor Muster, which was the Cananda Gymkhana, was created as a way to raise funds for the Royal Flying Doctors Service and the Isolated Children's Hospital. And in the early 90s, it transformed into what is now the Nullarbor Muster, and still does a fantastic job of raising funds for both the RFDS and local charities. It's an important service and something that a lot of people who attend the muster have a very strong connection to. A lot of people worked for RFDS or they've used RFDS. If you're living on the land, it's a big part of your life. So, yeah, very important weekend in those terms. And just in terms of people catching up and meeting up with friends. It's great for them to see each other. It's a key social event in this part of the world and sort of one of the only times they will get to see their fellow station workers who are spread out across this big, wide southern part of Western Australia and South Australia. So, yeah, it's very exciting.
Mm. Well, look, speaking from experience, you want to get yourself a good position to watch the arm wrestling tomorrow night. So good luck, and we'll hear more from you on the Rural Report next week.
Thanks, Tara. Appreciate it.
That's Kalgoorlie reporter Macy Turner at the Nullarbor Muster, which is around 380 kilometres east of Kalgoorlie, up for a big weekend. There's plenty on: gymkhanas, kids and novelty events. As I mentioned, the arm wrestling, skeet shooting, of course, lots and lots happening, the rodeo as well. So plenty out on the Nullarbor this weekend. It's coming up 14 minutes to one. Well, 77 projects will share in $11.2 million as part of the state government's latest round of exploration incentive scheme funding. The co-funded drilling program was recently expanded, making this round one of the biggest yet across its 16-year history. Warren Pearce from the Association of Mining and Exploration Companies says there was a significant focus on critical minerals in this round of EIS. And given the federal support for the industry, he expects that trend to continue.
The co-funded drilling scheme received a boost at their last election. It's been doubled in size, which means more companies obviously get a chance to apply for the allocations. And indeed, it means they've got to go and get the other 50% of the funding from private investors, which is great. We've got 77 projects across all of Western Australia, all regions, I think except the Metro, Peel and South West. So essentially all of regional Australia is getting a bit of a piece of that. And indeed, really focused on some really quite interesting things in a wide range of minerals: rare earth, lithium, platinum group elements, gold and copper, of course, but also zinc and lead, and some others in there as well. So, good program. Really good to see people getting amongst it.
So, is there any region in particular and any mineral or target in particular that you see out of this list of 77 projects which are being funded to the tune of $11.2 million?
There's a range of projects that are quite interesting, but what this program tries to do is push exploration investment into areas that probably are underexplored. So if you're looking in the Goldfields Esperance, for example, you're going to get projects focusing on what the Goldfields is known for, gold primarily, but you've also got them looking at rare earths and critical minerals there. Really interesting is the focus on the Paterson district up in the eastern Pilbara. There's some in the southern Kimberley as well, and we've got a bit of a push through the Gascoyne, where you don't see a lot of activity, but actually it's considered quite prospective for critical minerals. So it's good to see some exploration activity happening there. It's places you don't often always see it, and that's really where new mineral jurisdictions and big discoveries might be made in areas that have been underexplored in the past. We've got an awful lot of country here in Western Australia to cover. So continue to turn over new ground creates new possibilities.
That's Warren Pearce, the CEO of the Association of Mining and Exploration Companies. Well, circling back to where we began the program this morning, because at Anzac Day marches around the state today, you might have spotted a slouch hat with emu feathers fluttering in the breeze. I certainly did on our first guest this lunchtime, Scott Lawrence, and that's because this distinctive plume symbolises the Australian Light Horse, mounted soldiers renowned for their bravery, hardiness and skill in the desert battlefields of the First World War. And as Emily Doak reports, two Army veterans are doing their part to make sure the tradition of the emu plume continues.
The Australian Light Horse wore slouch hats adorned with emu plumes, or as some larrikin soldiers were known to call them, kangaroo feathers. The tradition dates back to the Queensland shearer strike in the 1890s, when mounted soldiers were reported to have chased emus to pluck feathers for their hats. Emu plumes are still worn by members of the Australian Armoured Corps today. And for Captain Henry Lindsay, who's originally from Wagga Wagga, it's a source of great pride.
It is quite a powerful symbol. You know, there's no other corps or group that can wear embellishments in their slouch hat. And it is quite noticeable when you walk around in public or on base. When the emu plumes are flying, you know that there's someone from the Royal Australian Armour Corps there. And just knowing that every Royal Australian Armour Corps soldier and officer to date has continued wearing the plumes, and being able to trace that lineage all the way back to World War I is something that I'm personally quite proud of to be a part of.
These days, getting feathers doesn't involve catching a wild emu. It's where retired soldier and plume maker Dale Kirkman comes in.
So it's all about the fullness of the plume and some of the colour, because the tradition was the darker the feather, the better the rider for the light horse. Therefore, some of them with have a darker tinge on the end. Therefore, it allows the owner of the plume or the wearer of the slouch hat to meaning they're a good horse rider back in the day. So that was a tradition that was there. So I try to get feathers with nice tips on them and having enough quills on the feather so it looks okay. Otherwise, it looks a bit strangly. So I get a number of these put together to put into a clamp and glue it with that. It allows the feather to look with that layered effect as well, so it falls nicely over the slouch hat.
This niche hobby began 20 years ago when Dale was still in the army and needed a new plume for his own hat. He went to see a fellow soldier, Ian Marston, who also ran a small emu farm at The Rock in southern New South Wales.
And he said, "Oh, can I get some feathers?" I said, "Oh, rightio. So you've got to come out and work for me, though." He said, "Rightio." So that relationship's now been going on for 20 years, and he just makes the perfect plumes for the military and is a... he's a real professional. The grunting noise is the male. Of course, we've got a low vocabulary. And the drumming noise is the female.
What does it take to grow a good emu to have those top-notch feathers?
Well, it's nutrition as well, Emily. It's like anything. If your genetics for a start, so you don't want to have scraggly emus with hardly any feathers. You know, sort of, if you're growing feathers... in the emu industry, if you compared it, you wouldn't have Dorper emus, you'd have Merino emus. So that's a different type. So there's plenty of nice type of feather that's involved there. And, of course, the nutrition, they've got to have the correct feed. And we do special diets for them. And we try things all the time to see if we can improve their shine on their feathers and their coats, and as well as improve the oil and the meat flavour and testing as well.
The key product from the emus is the oil used in supplements, skincare and cosmetics. But the feathers, along with meat, leather and eggs, all add to the profitability.
These ones behind us are about 18 months and they will go to market this year. So they'll go in the next month or so. The product we get off, and we get around about 9.5 kilos of fat per bird as the ones you see behind us on an average. And that renders down to about 8 litres of oil.
And how many feathers?
And there is, I don't know, do you want to try and pluck one? We'll try and have a look and see how it goes. But there's a lot of feathers off each bird.
You know, in an industry like emus, how important is it to have a diversification of uses for the products that come from the bird?
There never seems to be a straight line where it's continually going up. It's like a roller coaster in any industry. So you're going up and down all the time. So you can diverse from oil to feathers. You can store feathers. Feathers last forever. because we're such a small industry and it's such a neat niche product that there's always a demand for the meat.
After the boom and bust of emu farming in the 90s, the Australian industry is now small with about 20 farms, but most are well established. President of the Emu Industry Federation of Australia, Chris Gregory, says oil production last year was about 45 tonnes.
The demand of emu oil throughout the world is growing into countries such as the US, Korea, Taiwan, even China is growing in its inquiries in recent times, Singapore and so on. So we have a number of markets that have been established for a long period of time, and we've got new markets that are constantly inquiring about emu oil as a commodity.
It might surprise you to hear that emus are also farmed in the US, India and China, although Mr Gregory says the numbers are small and the industry in those countries has been hampered by a lack of knowledge and capacity to value add.
While they were able to successfully grow emus, they really didn't know what to do with them after that. A lot of countries were using the birds to farm for emu meat, and we only get a very small proportion of meat off a bird. So it was not successful. They also did not have the technology or the understanding of how to process and render the oil and to value-add product from there.
Ian Marston says there's also another advantage of Australian-farmed emu oil, genetically superior birds.
But we have a little secret that most people don't realise, and that is that there are five different varieties of emu. So you can have emus in America and China or whatever, but they might not be the right kind of emu. For our vitamins, for our vitamin K2, the farmers have got the same type of bird or very similar to each other in Australia, and we can produce a high level of K2 in the oil.
And in fact, you're undertaking genetic selection to improve that even further.
That's correct. As I mentioned, there was five different varieties, and we know which variety has the most potent oil in it.
That's Southern New South Wales emu farmer Ian Marston ending that report from Emily Doak. And you can watch that full story on Landline this Sunday from 12:30 on ABC TV or on iView. Now, before we head to the footy, large parts of southwest Queensland are still grappling with the after effects of severe flooding. After record-breaking rainfall, vast areas of western and central Queensland were submerged. Thousands of livestock have died and lots of infrastructure has been washed away as well. A number of charity organisations are offering their support for those affected, and Queensland-based Rural Aid is one of them. The organisation was established in 2015, so that's a decade of helping people on the land recover from natural disasters. Golden guitar-winning artist Josh Arnold felt that milestone deserved a song.
We can pitch in when times are tough, kicking some dollars to an empty cup. We can't fix it all or shift the tide, but we can pick the spirits up. When the people come together for Australians on the land, through drought, flood and fire, rural aid is there to lend us.
That's There to Lend a Hand by Josh Arnold, and you can hear the full version on Spotify. Just search There to Lend a Hand, or you can check out Josh Arnold's Instagram account as well. And if you're wondering what Rural Aid does to help people after natural disasters, they've been working with the Queensland government with things like airlifting bales of hay by chopper to properties where they were cut off by floods. That's obviously pretty important for livestock when it's unsure how long it will take for floodwaters to subside and supply routes to reopen. And Rural Aid has also tried to help affect landowners financially. Some have been given prepaid Visa cards, providing them with direct financial assistance as well. Rural Aid CEO Mr John Waters has been coordinating relief efforts in Charleville and says the scale of the disaster is overwhelming, but it's the ongoing generosity of the public that makes a real difference to those impacted. Now, with Anzac Day and Easter, there were no wool sales this week, so we'll have our wool reporters back on deck next Friday and they'll let you know how sales fare.
Thanks for your company on this Anzac Day, broadcasting from the Esperance Studios in the state southeast. Great to hear from you. Rob in the Great Southern, he said he's going to finish seeding tomorrow into mostly wet soils. That's a month early. The canola's all up and some barley as well. Best start to the season in 20 years, maybe even 40 years. And Froggy from northeast Katanning has said they've just finished canola, had a good drop of rain. The best thing is all the green feed up early for our ponies. Nothing better than seeing them roam around in that fresh grass as the sun rises. Just love it. Good for you, Froggy. Now, Belinda Varaschetti will be back with you on Monday. I hear she may have recovered from the football by then. We know that's how she's spending her spare time. Though, let's head to the football now, where it is Collingwood versus Essendon at the MCG.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.